in the universe, who exist in their various kala chakra, or schedule of eternal time. So this kala chakra,
if we look at this universe, this universe is also called the Sistamata chakra. Sistamata refers to the universe. If you look at the universe from above, it looks like a dolphin. So, you know, the Sistamata chakra, and it pivots around the pole star, Dhruva-loka, but it looks like a dolphin. And because of the that, just like a clock, you know, you have the pivot in the center, and then you have the hands. The one hand is going very quickly, or the three hands, you've got seconds, minutes, and hours. They're all pivoting around the same part, but one rotation of seconds is very quick compared to, you know, it's 1/60th of the time it takes to for 1 minute to rotate, and 1/60th of the time a minute for 1 hour, like that. Although they're all rotating around the same, each had a different kala chakra. So the universe is from the clock, like that. But the, you know, the arms of the clock would be the movement of the sun, like that. The Sistamata chakra, one of the names, when we chant the 108 names of Lord Narasimhadeva, one of his names is Sistamata. You can call Lord Narasimhadeva Sistamata as well, because as Krishna showed Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, that universal form is the form of time. The universe itself is the form of time. And Krishna showed Arjuna the universal form. Arjuna said, "Who are you?" He said, "I am time." So the universal form is also a part of time. And therefore, time is one of the forms of Krishna, or, you know, any of his various expansions, such as Lord Narasimhadeva. And we can, when we pray to Lord Narasimhadeva, we know that he protects us from the various obstacles on the path of devotional service, all which arrive in due course of time, of which he is time. All living entities have their schedule of eternal time, and Maitreya has described the residents of various planetary places, and now he is being asked about the residents who are not affected even at the end of Brahma's day. In this third canto, it describes that at the this Padmakalpa, we hear the description how Lord Brahma appeared on the top of the lotus that had emanated from the navel of Gavadaksha Vishnu. And that is because in this particular day of Brahma, that scenario repeated itself, Padma Kalpa. At the end of Brahma's day, there is not always a Padma Kalpa, where the universe is completely wound up and then again sprouts as a lotus, in which Brahma appears the top of that lotus, and then all the personalities such as Bhrigu and Brahma's sons and etc. And then gradually manifest. So not every Brahma's day has that scenario. At the end of Brahma's day, generally there is a partial inundation. So, and so just like Sanatana and Bhrigu and various personalities reside with Brahma and unaffected. So he's inquiring about those very elevated planetary systems and their Kala Chakra, or schedule of eternal time. So the all of us have our each and every one of us has our Kala Chakra, just like astrologically, there is a system called Vinchotari, and humans, you can tell where they appear in this Kala Chakra according to the star where the moon is placed at the time of birth. So the Vinchotari system is 120-year system, and the where the moon is placed at the time of your birth, you can see where you come into that 120-year system, and what is your Kala Chakra, which runs out at a certain time, starts at a certain time, ends at a certain time. On this planetary system, of course, we generally have 100 years in Kali Yuga. Some, live between 100 and 130, some people, there are people still on this earth about, some about over 100, and getting on to 110. And of course there are some yogis who are, I have one book at home, shows the Kumbh Mela, and there are pictures of yogis there who are, some hundreds and hundreds of years old. And Srila Prabhupada also pointed out various persons who are centuries old at the Kumbh Mela. So, but generally, 100 years, or just a little over, is the time duration. So everything operates according to various time calculations. And understanding that is very important, because we know that we have a limited amount of time to ultimately try and perfect our lives and go back to the spiritual world. But generally people don't do that. Generally, no one looks at that, fixed time that they have. All the living entities in this world, try to make a within that as they live in this world, we try to create a nice home, create a nice family, just like they call the great Australian dream. But if you ask the average person in Australia what is the great Australian dream, they will not say, I can develop my pure love of God and try to go back to God here. They will say, the great Australian dream, if I can own my own home. That's it. And most Australians, this average Australian family, will work their entire life for that, even it takes the entire duration of their life. Because that is the dream. And if you achieve that, then your golden life has been achieved. Okay. So, I was watching a documentary about the earthquakes that hit Kathmandu and that area, and, you know, between Mount Everest and Nepal, because that particular area is sits on the fault line between the two plates. So that running along the Himalayas, you have one, you know, plate of the Earth's crust, and it pushes in under the Himalayas like that and creates pressure, and every so many hundreds of years that pressure is released in the form of earthquakes. So every so many hundred years, big one. So it's not a matter of if, but well, that's what the sciences say. You know, it's not a matter of if we'll have an earthquake. Similarly in New Zealand, they also, New Zealand, that place between Wellington and the North Island and the South Island, generally most earthquake places have one particular type of fault. You know, where sometimes the plates, as we said, one pushes in under the other, or sometimes they slide against each other, and there's a third one, can't remember what it is offhand, but that part has all three. So, you know, already, you know, that massive land has been split in half. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And of course they had the big earthquakes in Christchurch a couple of years ago, which even shattered the temples. And of course in Kathmandu, you know, many ancient buildings for been there for centuries, you know, came crumbling down. But you will see that straight away, the rebuilding begins to make a home in exactly the same place. And the generation, you know, so you know, the generations will come, so after a few generations, everything that's been built up, again, according to a certain time, will again be smashed down again. And then you'll see immediately after, again, and so of course we may be amazed, but that we actually do that ourselves. You know, that is what generally everyone does in this world. We, you know, sometimes when I'm doing the little ceremonies with the children, I mention this, that, and always get a bit of a startled look from the parents, that here is your child. And I ask how old, well, 6 months. And they said, if you go back, you know, the past 6 months, this child had a whole different family. And they're like, what? You know, and you see the jealousy, you know, of the family. And, you know, and you tell them yes, and the child will again create a family, grow, create a family. And then at the end, after, you know, some years, the soul will leave the body, and again another family. And they go, what? Another family? You know, because they're attached. This is my child, you know. But they, so then I just move on quickly, because they can't, you know, that concept, they just quickly put it out of their mind. As soon as you've said it, it's gone. Oh, no, we've got plans, you know, what are you going to do? This and that, you know, like that. So, you know, you see that frightened look for a second, and then it's just gone. You see, they just completely put it out of their mind, like that. But at least they've heard it once. They've heard, you know, the teachings of the Gita once. And some, you know, may think, you know, sometimes some of them may think, oh, you know, I'm going to consider that a little bit more carefully, that that's very rare. But generally, even if we hear that, we do the same thing. There's a, for the devotees, of course, we try to develop that consciousness that really we just have one thing to do in this life, and that is to revive our eternal identity and relationship as the servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Try to not become entangled in the, you know, making a nice home for the body in this world, because really that's what we do. We try to make a nice place for the material body, but ultimately, according to time, everything will be smashed to pieces. So there's King Canute, where that saying comes from: time and tide wait for no one. Prabhupada also tells that story. King Canute, he was, you know about King Canute? I always wonder whether he was an actual person, but I did see the documentary on King Canute. Was a, he was one of the Vikings who, about maybe 1,000 years ago, they used to go to England, because England had lots of coins, they had, you know, good mints, and they would go there and they would pillage and, you know, kill, and they would say, "But if you give us lots of money, we won't kill you so much." And so that the English would get given the money and they'd go back. And he became one of the kings in England. He became so powerful, and he was also at the coronation of Constantine in somewhere in Europe. And he became a very, very powerful person. But he made the kingdom, the Danish kingdom, into a Christian kingdom. And to show, this is what they say, to show that he was a mortal, he had, you know, that he wasn't a god, as sometimes people think, these great warriors are, that they're warring with the various gods and the many gods, and well, they're a god, like Alexander the Great thought he was a god. He wanted to show that actually he was a mortal, a mortal person, and so he, to propagate that, he sat by the ocean and told the tide not to come in. And of course the tide did come in, and in this way he showed he didn't have that power. So if you get that saying, time and tide wait for no one, the tide will come in, and because we, these mortal bodies, we're not in a spiritual body, we're not the Supreme Lord, the material energy, the tides of time will come and smash everything to pieces. So the devotees have a very serious attitude, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter 241. Their consciousness is, their intelligence is fixed on one purpose, not many grams. That they don't have so many goals, they don't have any goals really. As Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati called to say that we did not come into this world to become carpenters and bricklayers. or IT. but I think people often say that I found my calling, I found my mission, as if I was born to do this. There's songs about that, do what you were born to do. But actually, we were born to get out of this material world, really, and be born in the human form. That's really what you're actually taking birth to do, is to just get out of the material world. You don't plan to, as Bhaktisiddhanta says, what did you call it to say, that this world is not a fit place for ladies and gentlemen. It's not a fit place to be. So that is a very serious move of the body. At the same time, devotees are not bored or they don't lead very boring and uninteresting lives. Devotees, despite there's an intensity and there's a race against time in one sense to try and attain spiritual perfection before you leave this material body. But at the same time that is there, the devotees are developing their love of God. The devotees are relishing their relationship with Krishna and Krishna's devotees on a moment-to-moment basis. If you see the old movies and what have you, Srila Prabhupada, and you see Srila Prabhupada eating. There's one there where they just sort of Prabhupada's in his room, he's got a few disciples just eating, looks like some dates or some fruits or something. But it's just like he's in his own complete little world. He's sort of interacting, but you can see that he's just thoroughly relishing that prasadam. And you see that the picture upstairs, where he's sitting there, he's sort of just walking the door, because he's just facing the wall. He's got the prasadam on the table, and he's just, there's him in that prasadam. He's just completely, and Prabhupada would relish that moment that here is Krishna's mercy. Krishna has tasted this food and I'm eating, honoring Krishna's prasadam. So much so, an intense meditation on that prasadam. I think it was here in Melbourne, one time they brought him the offering plate, and I just gave him the offering plate, and he was eating, and he tasted the puris and various things, and he says, who has cooked this prasadam? And they said, Purma Prabhu, Srila Prabhupada. Oh, he is Krishna conscious. He is following the regular principles. So he can taste that in the puris. And he can sense. You can just see the full attention to honoring Krishna prasadam. And you see in one of my favorite sections of all the Srila Prabhupada's books, it is a section of the nectar devotion where it describes the benefits of accepting Krishna's Mahagardens, or you know, to smell the incense, or to bow the head on the ground. You hear, and you know, they give such beautiful descriptions that one who, you know, accepts the prasadam and they get these benefits, one who accepts the garden and smells the incense. And you can just see so much mercy, so much nectar, like that, so much friendship from Krishna. So the devotee, although is very serious and fixed mind, but at the same time, they're actually relishing Krishna consciousness. Well, they're actually trying to become Krishna conscious. Because the race against time is to become Krishna conscious. To be conscious of Krishna. This is Krishna's garden. It's not just an ordinary garden. That lack of consciousness we saw was there in Indra. When he was on his elephant and he was passing along, and his guru was coming down that same path from a different direction and offered him a garland as a sign of his mercy. And Indra put that garland on the head of his elephant, who threw it on the ground and trampled it. So Indra became cursed by his was it Brigham? Who is his spiritual master? Was it Brigham? And therefore offended a Brahmana and the spiritual master. He took offense at that he was negligent with that mercy. You know, he didn't pay attention. And because of that negligence, they lost the whole heavenly planets. So serious. Just like because of our negligence of Krishna's mercy, we have lost the whole spiritual world. Become negligent of Krishna's friendship and Krishna's mercy. The whole spiritual world is also, we've lost that. Although there is an urgency, a very intense desire within the devotees, still they are spending time taking each and every moment to relish Krishna consciousness. And of course, one of the most relishable aspects of Krishna consciousness is association with devotees. An opportunity to relish Krishna consciousness in one of its most nectarian ways. Therefore, I think Ramananda Rao, he was asked by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what is the most greatest suffering? And he said, to not have the association with others is the most suffering greater than that. Without the association with others. He was relishing, above all things to relish, and he was saying, and take so many things away, but you take that away. There is no worse situation than that. So, and of course, the devotees of the Lord, they are, each and every living entity, what to speak of the devotees, but each and every living entity, is in fact a resident of the spiritual world, and in the Bhagavad Gita it teaches that we see each living entity as Brahman or a spirit soul, But even more, as devotees progress in their spirituality, they see that each of those particles of Brahman is an individual spiritual person, a resident of the spiritual world. Which reminds you that that story, I'm not sure the whole details, but one guru, was it Ramanuja that meant the devotees were fighting against each other, and he said that one amongst you will become guru, and so they all started treating each other with great respect, that perhaps he may be the guru, perhaps. And you know, so when they started to see each other like that, then they stopped quarreling, because they started looking at each other, that, oh, perhaps this person is the guru. They started seeing this. I see all these good qualities that I didn't see before, like that. I'm not sure the exact details. But, and of course, as devotee described in the Bhagavad Gita, that we are influenced by the modes of material nature, but when one transcends the modes of material nature, and Arjuna inquired, you know, what are the symptoms of one who transcends the modes of material nature? And Krishna describes those characteristics, and further describes that one who transcends the modes of material nature, that person, of course, comes to the level of Brahman. So one's spiritual qualities, one's spiritual nature, actually begins to manifest when one transcends the modes of material nature. And of course, that then one can engage in devotional service. So then one's spiritual identity begins to slowly manifest. You know, sometimes the devotees want to know what is their spiritual identity, and what happens is that because in one sense all devotees are doing a very similar thing, sometimes we may think that, well, I can't manifest my individuality because I'm just doing what all the other devotees are doing, like that. And when I want to manifest my individuality, of course, if we have transcended the modes of nature, when we try to manifest our spiritual individuality, we're really just manifesting our individuality according to our condition, according to the modes of material nature. So, first, one has to understand one's spiritual identity in a general way. I'm not this body. I'm eternal. I'm the servant of Krishna. We first have to come to that general platform. If we can't understand our spiritual identity generally, how is it possible to understand our spiritual identity specifically? So devotees have to first rise above the modes of material nature by becoming fixed up in devotional service. Then when the modes of material nature are no longer acting upon the devotee, and they're fully engaged in devotional service, at that point, gradually from the general understanding of our spiritual identity, more and more our specific individual nature becomes manifest. And you see also in the Brahma Samhita, Lord Brahma said that as well, that when Krishna revealed to him a great transcendental realization by which he then spoke the Brahma Samhita, he realized that he was the eternal maidservant of the Lord, generally, but gradually, by slow degrees, that more specific understanding is developed. So first we have to come to this point, which says that The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear. So that's I always love that, as a devotee, certain things affect the body and the mind as you go through life. It's like Arjuna was affected in one sense, but one does not become attached to them when they're present, nor long for them when they disappear. You know, things, because we're in the material world, things happen to the body and the mind, but the devotee, they perceive that, but they don't become attached to it, and they don't long for it. They remain on a different platform. He is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental. Knowing that the modes alone are active. So even though the modes are active, because you know, we have a material body, so for instance, the modes are active means that this body will be destroyed. That's the action of the modes of material nature. This body will be completely destroyed. Even the mind will be completely destroyed. The fame and the hand, everything related to the body will be destroyed. That's a mode. But the devotee remains neutral and transcendental. So the effect of the modes will take its toll. He is situated in the self in regard to life happiness and distress. He looks upon the lump of earth, the stone, and the peace of God with an equal eye, who is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honor and dishonor, who treats them like both friend and enemy, who has renounced all material activities. Such a person is said to have transcended the modes of nature. So of course, this is the daily activities of the devotee, is trying to develop these qualities here. Not easy. And then he says, Manchayoga vicharana bhakti yogina sevati sarvanam sampeja chandrama bhuvya prabhutena. One who engages in full devotional service and that in all circumstances at once transcends the mode of mature nature and thus comes to the level of pramana. So that is that process, that we just engage in devotional service, but we should be able to gauge by the previous verses whether we're actually coming to the level of Brahmana. So not that we have no idea of been doing devotional service, but I don't know if I'm making advancement or not. If you want to know if you're making advancement, then look at the previous verses. See how well we do with that list of qualities that we should be developing. So this is the mood of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita that we take very, very seriously, that we have a very short span in Kali Yuga, very short life, running out very quickly, and it's a race against time to, when we leave this body, to have developed a love of God sufficiently. Yeah. And but at the same time, that does not make us harsh or uncaring persons, that because we're so ambitious in our devotional lives, that we can't relish the association of devotees, or you know, be very respectful and loving. Making advancement, sometimes making advancement in devotional service can be confused. That, you know, I'm making advancement, so I just don't have time. You know, I'm becoming too advanced. You know, my friends, we see that as a short prophet, even while eating the food, he can taste the reciprocation of the lady. There's no more advance. Actually, Prabhupada shows that the more advanced you become, the more you should be able to reciprocate the devotees. Not the more advanced you become hard-hearted. You know, like I said, sometimes it's confusing. Anyway, any questions there? Is there? Yeah,
yeah. I've got one comment and one question. Comment is, last month's Reader Digest.
Reader's Digest?
Reader Digest.
Yep.
This May 2015, there is a very nice article of reincarnation. A little boy, 2 years old, he can tell all about truth. Of course, they were telling him, he was a Disneyland. And he could tell the mother what was his role in the inserted picture. I mentioned 9 by 9 or something. So now people are really more and more in the incarnation. Now they know that life and intent is one body.
Yes.
That was my comment. Now my question, how to know our spiritual identity? Can you give us some?
Yes, as I was saying there, first we understand our spiritual identity genuinely, and then as we engage in devotional service, and reciprocate love with the devotees and the Lord, and the spiritual master, and our spiritual identity manifests.
Okay. Basically, what do you
mean? As we advance. As we advance. As we become less conditioned by the modes of material nature, and there is no tinge of the material nature, and we're engaging in devotional service, then that spiritual identity manifests more and more. By gradual degrees. Prabhupada said, liberation is by degrees. Lord Brahma says a similar thing. We sometimes have a concept that, you know, one day, bang, I'll be liberated, I'll know who I am. You know, actually, we understand who we are by degrees. Just like, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you wake up and you sort of, you know, you start to realize, you think, oh yeah, it's, I'm younger, and oh, I'm supposed to be work or whatever, you know, like that. I'm supposed to be the best of the years. and you know, gradually, everything just gradually kicks in by the bridge. You don't just necessarily wake up and, So it's like that. You know, the person's been unconscious. Sometimes that even when they become conscious, they can't remember who they were or what they were doing. And then it's 5 degrees. But, you know, even though people hear about reincarnation and they have faith in that there is life after death, it doesn't make them say, now I strive to attain the Buddha. That part eludes them. They think, oh, reincarnation. Oh, my next life, I think I'd love to take birth as a horse. Or a dog. You know, and Prabhupada was teaching in the universities, some of them were saying they wanted to take birth as dogs. And Prabhupada understood this because then they can have sex life without, you know, any shame. Well, without shame. Because as a human being, you know, if you have sex life shamelessly, you become shamed in society, whereas a dog can do what they don't. So they actually think, well, you know what, you know, human being is a worse bird, better off they birth than a dog. So when people believe in reincarnation, it doesn't necessarily give them the same perspective that we have. That you have to hear from Gita. See, so the Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, by associating with devotees, therefore, you know, how much we appreciate the association with devotees, because everything is properly given in perspective, which is discussed more in tomorrow's verse. So stay tuned.
I just want to know, does Krishna still love the living entity who offends his devotee?
Oh yes, Krishna does. Krishna still love the devotee who offends, he may commit Vaishnava Parada. He certainly does, that's why he goes to the trouble to punish them.
Thank you.